What is bioethics? One or two people asked me this, and I thought I'd better just say what the word means. Bioethics, it's where theology and biology overlap. It's where morality and healthcare interact. It's where Christianity and, sadly, the NHS have a slightly uncomfortable relationship, perhaps we could say. And it's where God and politics both want your heart. Now, this is roughly the format. We need to look first at why this is relevant to all of us, so we'll do that in a second. We need to do some theology because, as Christians, obviously, we should have a very different view of bioethics from those around us. We just need to have a quick reminder of some sub-GCSE level human biology as well. We also need to look at some terminology because there's some misinformation out there that we need to be aware of. And then I have four examples of how bioethics affects, in particular, the unborn. And I'm hoping that Professor John Wyatt from UCH, who's coming here in March, we'll be able to talk more on the other end of the age range, covering things like euthanasia. So we're slightly unbalanced tonight, but only a bit. After all, euthanasia isn't actually legal in this country. Not yet, anyway. Then to end with, we must put everything into some sort of context, the gospel. So I'm hoping that we can do it well by putting some theology at the beginning and the gospel at the back end and make it all as it should be, really. Because this is a very difficult subject to talk about. And when I say to talk about, I don't just mean me talking about it, although I admit it has proved rather difficult to prepare this presentation. But you too need to talk about this subject as well. And that's because there are basically two groups of people involved. There are people who have a lot of pain in their lives about bioethical issues. And there are people who have no pain, okay? The ones who have a lot of pain would be infertile couples, and I think unless you are one of them, you really don't understand the level of pain that's involved, from what I can tell. There are women who would like to take various pills and things who are wrestling with moral dilemmas because they know a little bit about them, that sort of thing, that's painful. There are people who've had abortions. There are teenagers who may be tempted into having sex by things like peer pressure or alcohol and things like that. And there are others who are rather careless and thinking that they can always take a morning after pill or something like that to avoid getting pregnant. So there's a huge amount of pain around in our society. And then, and this is what the slide is about really, there's probably the majority of Christians who aren't getting a lot of pain on the subject. Because 1967 and the Abortion Act is a long time ago, frankly. And yet the reality of that is that there are people who would be 2 years old, 12 years old, 22 years old, 32 years old, or even 42 years old, who are missing whenever there's a public gathering because of the 1967 Abortion Act. They're not here, you know, they're gone. So you could imagine there might be another three or four people amongst us tonight, apart from the 1967 Abortion Act. And I think most of us don't actually feel a great deal of pain about that, if we're honest. I admit I don't. Since 1967, there have been 6.7 million abortions out of a UK population of roughly 60 million. So 11% of people are missing. And we should feel great pain and a sense of national responsibility for that. So there are these two extremes of emotion associated with bioethical issues, and people tend to be on one extreme or the other. Now I'm going to try and walk between the two extremes, which means that neither side will be happy, of course, and you, when you talk to other people about this, have the same problem. So it's just how it is, I'm afraid, so we have to get on and do the best we can. And the formula, I believe, the biblical formula for doing the best we can involves being aware of and being balanced in how we talk to people and emphasising truth and love, achieving a balance of truth and love, by which I do not mean 50% love, 50% truth. What I mean is a balance of 100% truth and 100% love. So, there are some scriptures up there, as you can see. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 6. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. So you'll already notice these are all verses that mention the subject of truth and love, you see. That first one is saying that love and truth are totally compatible. They agree with each other. 1 John 3:18, dear children, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth. Love and truth are both active words. They're about doing. Love motivates our doing. Truth directs our doing. And we need both, as I said, 100%. Ephesians 4:15 talks about speaking the truth in love. Because love and truth both affect how we speak, how you and I speak about bioethical issues. We need both, love and truth. And then Psalm 26, verse 3, for your love is ever before me, and I walk continually in your truth. Your, there being God's love, God's truth. Love and truth both come from God. We must be motivated and guided by God and the Bible. In Psalm 40, David says, do not withhold your mercy from me, O Lord. May your love and your truth always protect me. If we do love and truth, what is the effect? It affords protection in the same way that God's love and truth protects us. So when we emphasize love and truth, so we can protect others. And of course, that protection includes protecting the unborn. Why should we be concerned about protecting the unborn? Surely they are the ones that people care least about in the world. Well, that's probably true in this country, although there are other countries where nobody seems to care a great deal about protecting those who have been born either. What about protecting the unborn? Well, life begins before birth. This is very obvious from Luke chapter 1, verse 41, when Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, because Mary had gone to visit Elizabeth, they were both pregnant. The baby, who's that? Well, it's a real person who's alive, later to be known as John the Baptist. He leapt in her womb, a real person. And so that verse in Proverbs says that we should speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. And surely that must apply to the unborn. Psalm 51 is an interesting psalm. It's where David is confessing his sin. And he speaks of himself and he says, surely I, a real person, you know, I, a human, I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. He recognised that not only was he a real person in his mother's womb and at conception, but that he was even sinful. Being sinful shows that you're really human, doesn't it? Can you see on that picture what's going on there? See those two babies in the pram? Those are actually my twin brothers. Brothers who are twins. And can you see what they're doing? They're fighting. And because they're my brothers, I know which one's on top and wielding a left to the chin of the other. It's amazing, isn't it? Where did they learn to fight? Where did that inclination come from? Well, Psalm 51, verse 5 explains it, doesn't it? He says, surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. You see, they were human at conception. We know that because they were sinful at conception. It's a funny thing to be human, isn't it? But what's the real reason why we should be interested in protecting human life? Is it because killing babies is nasty? Is it something like that? Is it something human-centred or man-centred? And obviously when we study the Bible, we realise that we need to be God-centred. The real reason for protecting human life is not because it's human, but because it is God-like. There's that fascinating verse, and this occurs several times in Genesis. Genesis 9 verse 6 is written just after the flood, where God gives a new law to Noah. And he says, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed." Now, we're not going to get into a discussion about capital punishment tonight, because it's actually the next bit of the verse that we're interested in, which is the reason. "For in the image of God has God made man." Man has been made, humans have been made, in the image of God. That's a fascinating statement, isn't it? What does it mean to bear the image of God? Because we all bear God's image. That's us it's talking about. We bear God's image. That should really make us sit up and go, "Wow." And then it should make us go, "What does that mean?" And I think rather than thinking, what does it mean to bear God's image, it's most helpful to ask the question, well, how do we bear God's image? How do we image God, if you like? Well, the Bible's very clear that we've been made to do things and to relate to each other in various ways and to behave in various ways. And the ways that we do things and relate to each other and behave are to be done as the image of God, so that we show the rest of creation what God is like. Then he gets the glory if we do it well. So, for example, Genesis tells us that we were made to rule over creation. God rules over creation, and he has put humanity over creation. When we do it well, we show what God is like. We image God. God works and rests, particularly in creation. When we work and rest, we image God. We show people what God is like. And then there are all sorts of relationships, perhaps especially a marriage relationship, which we understand especially from the New Testament, or maybe even from the Song of Solomon, is a picture of God and his people, a man and his wife. It's a picture of Jesus and his church. And then there's the relationship of fatherhood. If I'm a good father to my children, I show how God is a father to us, his children. And when we do these things well, we image God. We show people what God is like, and we give him glory. That is what we are for, bringing glory to God by imaging him. And so if we fail to protect the unborn humans who also bear the image of God, then we're not just committing a biological sin, you might call it. We're actually committing a theological sin. We're not sinning just against the unborn. We're actually sinning against God. And interesting that the biology agrees with the theology. Useful just to rehearse a little bit of biology. We don't do this in this auditorium very often, I don't think, do we? So here we have a marriage. That's called intended. A man and a woman coming together. And when they come together in that other way that we sort of don't like talking about, especially in church, of course. One of them, well, no, they both provide gametes. One of them provides sperm, there's one there. The other provides ova, or an egg. And of course, most of the time, nothing happens. But occasionally, one of those fuses with one of those, the egg, and that is a very special event. And in biology it's called fertilization. In Psalm 51 it was called conception, of course, but they're the same thing. One's a theological term, the other is the biological term. Hence me saying that bioethics is when biology and theology meet, of course. And if you don't take anything else away from this evening, seeing that as the most special event is the thing that we all need to be very clear about and understand crystal clear. Because when the sperm and the egg fuse, what you get is an embryo. And that embryo is unique. It's a unique human person. It wasn't true before fertilization. It is true just after. And so this embryo, We could call it a child. We could call it a baby. Well, that's perhaps a bit of a funny thing to call it because it is microscopically small, obviously. It then grows. I don't know whether you can see that picture. It doesn't grow in the sense of getting any bigger. It grows by multiplying cells. And it follows a sort of scent because it's looking for its mother's womb. It's looking for the wall of her womb, what I've called womb lining there. It follows a sort of hormonal scent because as it multiplies cells, it works down towards the womb lining where it puts down kind of roots into the womb lining. And that is called implantation, if you can see the other yellow text. Implantation. And that's also a very important event. Unless the embryo manages to implant, it will never grow, it will just die, which is a very important consideration. Embryos need to implant in the wall of their mother's womb, otherwise they die. And in fact, the bit that actually implants in the womb is the placenta, because this embryo grows into two different pieces. There's the baby bit that goes on to grow, and there's the placenta, which is a big, squishy, ugly red thing that just gets chucked away after the baby's born. There is a picture of an embryo when it's 9 weeks old. At some point, it gets called a fetus, but it's just the same continuous human being. And then, you know what one of those is? That's a baby when it's born. And then, of course, it grows up, becomes an adult, hopefully marries, and the whole cycle starts over again. So I expect you knew most of that. What other things are there to say? I'll tell you something, though. Having had to do a little bit of research just to refresh my memory about this, I was reminded of those verses in Psalm 139 that Mike read out and thought, wow, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. It's remarkable how all this stuff happens inside the mother. The placenta is quite interesting because it joins onto the mother's womb, and it's effectively a combination of lungs and kidneys, pharmacy and supermarket for the growing baby. And of course, when the baby is born, it has its own lungs working and its own kidneys working, and it doesn't need the placenta anymore. Now that's quite significant, because there are two classes of human life. All that stuff we were talking about was human life, all of it, 100%. But there are some bits, mainly the sperm and the eggs and things like umbilical cords and indeed the placenta, that were designed by God to be disposable. It's not a matter of the fall that makes them disposable. It doesn't mean that something's gone wrong. Actually, most sperm and most eggs are designed to be disposable. All umbilical cords are designed to be disposable, and all placentas are designed to be disposable. And so in God's design, in his intention, these bits on the left are different from the bits on the right. They help, and they're very important and all that sort of thing, and we should never think them unimportant or anything like that. But it's the embryo that becomes a fetus, that becomes a baby, that becomes a child, that becomes an adult. It's that bit that is in the image of God. It's that part that bears the image of God and must be protected. And it's important to see that distinction. Difficult to know how exactly to talk about it. And, you know, is disposable the right word? I'm not sure, really. It sounds a bit like a razor blade, doesn't it? So maybe it isn't. But something like that is true. And the bit that's definitely true is that it's the embryo, the fetus, the baby, the actual human being that is in God's image and must be protected, but sadly isn't. And there are various institutions that would like fetuses, embryos, babies not to be protected, or at least only to be protected some of the time. They do not want the unborn to be protected. And we're talking sadly about the National Health Service. We're talking about drug companies. We're talking about abortion clinics. We're talking about the government, to name and shame them. And they don't want the unborn to be protected. And one way they do this is by inventing a new language, or rather redefining the language that we already have. Does anybody remember Newspeak? It was a novel written by George Orwell called 1984. And it was written before 1984 because he was looking to the future when a totalitarian government would try and control people's thinking and sort of deceive them so that they would be all placid and compliant and do what it wanted. And there's something a bit like Newspeak involving these words here that has been happening in the last 42 years. These words that used to mean something have been redefined, or extra words have been invented. So take the top phrase, because that's actually two words. A fertilised ovum, or egg. What's a fertilised egg? Well, you may remember there wasn't a fertilised egg on that diagram I showed you. I'll just give you the reminder. Where's the fertilised egg on that diagram? It's not there, is it? And of course, what they're referring to is that embryo there, because there's no such thing as a fertilised egg. There's an unfertilised egg there, but as soon as it's fertilised, it becomes an embryo. It becomes that unique human being. Why would they want to call it a fertilised egg? And the answer is sadly because if you destroy a fertilised egg, it doesn't sound too bad really, does it? It doesn't sound as bad as destroying an embryo, a fetus, a baby, a human, you see. And so you can read about that in a drug information leaflet for the pill, as it's known. You can read that kind of terminology even in a medical textbook, actually. I could even show you one where it talks about a fertilised egg. It's people just trying to hide slightly what's going on, you see. That's why I call it Newspeak. The same is true for pre-embryos. There's no such thing as a pre-embryo. It's an embryo. It's a person. It's a human. Contraceptive. That's an interesting one. What does contraceptive mean? It means some sort of method or possibly drug that stops conception from occurring. But sometimes when we're given information and they say contraceptive, they don't only mean that. Sometimes they don't mean it at all. Sometimes they mean something that will stop the embryo from implanting. Yep, given up. In the mother's womb, which is not the same as stopping conception from happening. In other words, what's called a contraceptive can sometimes actually destroy an embryo. And we need to be clear about these things and not be deceived, obviously. And then there's emergency contraception. That's the same thing, really. It's used to describe mainly the morning after pill, which mainly doesn't prevent contraception. It mainly destroys embryos. The same is true of post-coital contraception. That's mainly about destroying embryos. And what about the term pregnancy? That's an interesting one. How long is a pregnancy in a human? 9 months or 40 weeks? For some purposes, pregnancy has been redefined to be 39 weeks. The idea is that you can lose the first week. And then your abortion statistics graph, instead of going up like that, has some slightly smaller numbers in it because you don't count all the ones that happen in the first week, you see. So it's kind of handy to describe a period of pregnancy as only 39 weeks now, not 40. It's all very subtle. And then there's termination of pregnancy, which is just a pleasant way of saying an abortion, of course, which is a straightforward killing of the baby. It's very sad, but you can tell there's sort of some guilt behind that, I think. Just before we move off that slide, here's a question. Why would people try to redefine or invent some of these new phrases? Why would they do that, I wonder? It's important that we ask this question. And the answer is the usual answer. Idolatry, where the idol is something like a career, for example. We want to be able to get rid of embryos and fetuses so they don't mess up our career, that sort of thing. It's that kind of motivation. Or the idol of casual sex, or the idol of spontaneous sex. You want to take easy drugs, you know. Or the idol of your figure, perhaps mainly for women. But for men, the equivalent would be freedom from responsibility. There are male idols and female idols that might motivate us to do some new speak. And there's money, of course. All sorts of motivations that people might have to engage in new speak. So I just want to pick on four examples that we can talk about. Abortion, in vitro fertilisation, the morning after pill, and the combined oral contraceptive, which we can deal with in the same paragraph, as it were, as the progestogen-only pill. So just four examples, leaving Professor Wyatt to deal with things like euthanasia. First one, abortion. Hopefully, in the case of abortion, we just need to talk about what we should do about it. And I would urge you, therefore, to support various organisations to oppose it, and indeed to support those who are the victims of it as well. So support our options, organisations, support Life, CARE, SPUC, Society for the Protection of the Unborn Child. Support them, pray for them, give them money. They always need money. Then another thing we can do is we can vote pro-life. Sometimes it will be the right thing to do to vote pro-life. Perhaps it will often be the right thing to do to vote pro-life. That it probably just looks like a white rectangle on the right. That's actually a letter to me last year from David Wilshire, MP. You can read it. It's over there on the table if you want to have a look at it. And he said to me in his letter, whilst I am very unhappy about abortion, he's unhappy, okay, I believe it must be for individual parents to take their own decision rather than for Parliament to ban it. Because, you see, I wrote him a letter saying, are you pro-abortion or pro-life? And it doesn't sound to me as if you could exactly call him pro-life from that response. Maybe you couldn't actually call him pro-abortion either, and he's somewhere in the middle. Do you know about your MPs? Because David Wilshire is not everybody's MP in this room, I don't think. Do you know whether they're pro-life or pro-abortion? It should affect the way you vote. There are other issues to consider as well, but whether they're pro-life or pro-abortion must be an important issue to consider when you vote. And it's a bit sad, really, that David Wilshire will not be known when he resigns at the general election for being pro-abortion or not very pro-life. He'll be remembered for a little matter of £105,000 instead. But as Christians, we should care less about money and more about whether he was pro-life or pro-abortion, don't you think? Next one is in vitro fertilisation. So this is the so-called test tube babies and that kind of stuff. And the problem with it is to do with frozen embryos being destroyed. And the straightforward advice there would be avoid it. I've written down some of this stuff so that I can read it out and get it absolutely accurate and not make any fluffs, you know. And I wrote this. Sadly, and this is a very sad thing, this is a painful thing, many Christian couples are not able to conceive their own children in the womb in the normal way. They enter an IVF program, not really understanding that their sperm and eggs will be used in a laboratory to create new individual human beings. This fact is disguised by the fact that these new human beings, of course, are called embryos, and not everybody knows that an embryo is a unique human life. Because the process of planting embryos back inside the mother's womb is unreliable, IVF clinics fertilise a large number of eggs, creating a large number of embryos. As soon as the mother is pregnant, some or all of the remaining embryos are not needed. Eventually, they are destroyed. And so the rub is that by starting IVF, mothers are actually guaranteeing that some of their own embryos will be destroyed. And it's actually illegal for them to be given to anybody or else in this country. And what makes it extra sad is that there is other ethical infertility treatment available. It's not even as if IVF is the only option. There are these other things called GIFT and NAPRO technology, and you can read stuff about them on the table or go and have a look on the internet for yourself, of course. The morning after pill. This is to do with newspeak again. Do not be deceived, because the morning after pill is not mainly a contraceptive. Normally, an egg is fertilised inside the mother, becomes an embryo, and proceeds to implant itself in the wall of her womb. You remember that picture, I hope. The implantation process takes a number of days. So during this time, it is possible for an unimplanted embryo that has already become a new individual human being to be destroyed by means of the morning after pill. This pill is specifically designed to act as what's called an abortificent or an abortifacient. It prevents the newly conceived embryo from implanting in its mother's womb. And of course the danger is that a woman or a girl who is frightened at the thought of being pregnant might take the morning after pill in the belief that it is just contraceptive, whereas it's mainly designed to destroy embryos. And indeed there are other so-called contraceptives that at least sometimes destroy embryos. For example, the IUD, intrauterine device, sometimes called the coil. And then we move on to the combined oral contraceptive pill, and we can deal with it at the same time as the progestogen only pill. That one's sometimes known as the mini pill, whereas the combined oral contraceptive pill is usually just known as the pill when people talk about it. Now, the pill normally functions as a contraceptive. That is, it actually prevents conception from occurring. It prevents an embryo from being conceived. And I'm happy with the idea of contraception, but not all Christians are. Some Christians would be quite unhappy at that idea, and I respect them. I happen to disagree because of the business of the slide, which shows that some things are designed to be disposable and others are designed to bear the image of God. So if you interact with the process before conception, I would say that that is ethical according to what the Bible tells us. But I thoroughly respect and sympathise with those who don't even think that contraception is right for Christians. I just happen to disagree, I'm afraid. So that's what the pill does, most of the time, in most cases. But sometimes the pill acts to prevent the newly conceived embryo from implanting itself in the mother's womb. In other words, sometimes it doesn't work as a contraceptive, sometimes it fails, and then you have an embryo, a newly created, unique human being that wants to implant in its mother's womb and grow, and it can't, because the pill stops that from happening. It changes what the mother's womb lining is like to make it much less likely that the embryo can implant itself, and so it dies, which is obviously not ethical. Now, there are some claims that this may not be true, but I've checked information very carefully because I wanted to give you exactly accurate information. In fact, pill manufacturers rely on the anti-implantatory mode of the pill to make it reliable. So I've taken my information from three different sources to make sure it is true what I'm telling you this evening. I've also checked it with experts, including Dr. John Ling, whom some of you will have heard of. You can see some of his books that Mike MT has got there on the table for people to look at. I've looked in a medical textbook which just states, fairly baldly really, that these versions of the pill destroy embryos sometimes. And there's information from pill manufacturers that say the same thing. And there's a book from the Christian Institute on contraception, which you can also see on the table there. And the overwhelming weight of evidence in that is the same. But it does just hold out this claim that it may not be true. But even in that book, the overall weight of evidence presented is that the pill can sometimes risk killing embryos. And broadly speaking, there is the same problem with the mini pill, the progestogen-only pill. There's a picture of the Christian Institute contraceptives guide. But even in the case of this, you can't just look at these sort of handy list of what's pro-life and what isn't. You have to read very, very carefully all the words if you're going to get an accurate picture of whether you might be risking destroying your embryos or not. So read with care. My wife has reviewed this and says it is a good guide thing. And one big important message I want you to take away is that there are alternatives to all these things and measures and drugs that people use. In the case of abortion, there is the obvious alternative to having an abortion of adoption. And you can talk to the options people about some other options as well. Particularly in the case of IVF, there are lots of alternatives, GIFT and MAPRO and other things. The morning after pill. Mainly, the alternative is self-control and not getting drunk, I'm afraid. It's as bald as that. And in the case of the pill, meaning both the pills I talked about earlier, see the Christian Institute contraception guide for more information. I hate putting something like be suspicious on a slide, but with all the newspeak about, I couldn't think of another way of saying it. Be suspicious of advice from institutions. Always look for the pro-life alternative, and perhaps even the pro-life Member of Parliament as well. Avoid getting into ethically tricky situations in the first place. Always mix love and truth. And then the main thing we should be concerned about loving is the image of God. Humans who have been made in the image of God. Some of them are 6 feet tall and they're in the image of God. Others are very, very small, but they bear God's image, and we are called to love the image of God, for by so doing we love God. Now, does anybody feel upset? I'm sorry if you do. I feel upset talking about this kind of stuff. It ought to be upsetting, and there's something wrong with us if we don't feel at least a bit upset, to be honest. Are we perhaps burdened with a sense of national guilt or even personal guilt? Jesus said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." Jesus offers us rest by forgiving and accepting us. He says in Matthew 12, "And so I tell you, every sin and blasphemy will be forgiven men." Why did I read that verse out? I read that verse because sometimes I think we can imagine that biological sins are somehow harder for Jesus to forgive than all our other sins. We imagine that they're harder for him to forgive, and that is untrue. A couple of examples. Think of Rahab, the prostitute in Jericho, lived 3,400 years ago or thereabouts. She was a prostitute, okay. She must have been guilty of a few biological sins. I take it that is obvious. And yet, you know, she put her trust in God. She was accepted by God. She joined his people and she became an ancestor of the Lord Jesus Christ. She was that accepted and that much forgiven. Second example, 3,000 years ago, King David committed adultery. Very well known. Adultery, well, that's a biological sin, if ever there was one. 2 Samuel 12, verse 13. Then David said to Nathan, the prophet, who'd come to finger his sin and say, "You are the man." He says, "I have sinned against the Lord." So David was clear that this wasn't just a biological sin. He was clear that this was also a theological sin. And the prophet Nathan says an amazing thing, because just like that, he says, "The Lord has taken away your sin. You're not going to die." That's an amazing thing. How was it that God could forgive David's sin just like that, even his biological sin? And it was because roughly 1,000 years later, the Lord Jesus would come. He would go through that embryogenesis process himself, becoming a real human being. He was an embryo once. And he lived a perfect life for David. He died a sacrificial death, paying for David's sins, even his biological sins. So we should never think that biological sins are somehow harder to be forgiven than other sins. We always need to set all this bioethics stuff in the context of the gospel and the forgiveness that's offered to us by the Lord Jesus.